In the coming week, Saudi Arabia hosts a scaled-down Hajj. Turkey's historic Hagia Sophia begins its reconversion into a mosque, and tensions mount over the Grand Ethiopian Renaissance Dam. It's July 23rd, 2020, in time for The World Next Week. I'm Bob McMahon.
And I'm Jim Lindsay. Bob, let's kick off the show by discussing the annual Hajj that is set to begin next week. In years past, more than 2.5 million Muslims from around the world have traveled to the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia to complete the pilgrimage to Mecca. This year, because of COVID-19, Saudi officials have drastically scaled down the Hajj. How will this year's pilgrimage look different from ones in the past?
Jim, as you indicate, it's a scaled-down version, and like so many other events tailored to many people, this one is going to be sparse. When we think of Hajjs in the past, and we think of the coverage that you've seen, it is always about masses of people. There are various rituals that are required to be performed in the Hajj, one of which is the circling of the Kaaba, which is found within the Grand Mosque of Mecca. But you're talking about a limit of 1,000 people now being able to perform the Hajj, as opposed to 2.5 million that you indicated have been the average number from around the world. This 1,000 people includes Saudi nationals and foreign nationals who happen to be within Saudi Arabia. So a very carefully selected number of people who can perform the Hajj this year. Mecca, obviously extremely holy and significant for Islam. It is where the Prophet Muhammad was born. It is where he is said to have received the first revelations from Allah, and that went on to become the Quran, which is the Muslims' holy book. Muslims pray in the direction of the Kaaba. This is the sacred building that you've seen the photos from afar of, the sort of square-shaped black building within the Grand Mosque. And this is all to symbolize the oneness of God, and all sorts of other rituals are performed as well. And it's going to be anything we see and hear from the Hajj this year is going to be flavored with a sense of distancing. There's going to be more of an emphasis on people trying to take part in the experience through software, through the virtual experience, as so many other religions have had to do. We've already had the Friday prayers in many Muslim services have become a virtual experience. We've had this happen. Weekend services, Saturday and Sunday, and other religions have become live streamed affairs in many cases. There's a few areas where people have gone back into religious places of worship, but it's all with the social distancing. It's all with masks, or almost all. And so the Hajj is yet another high profile event that's going to be altered in a way that it really hasn't faced in its many, many year history.
But do we know how the Saudis decided which pilgrims get to make the trip to Mecca? Obviously, this is an important part of Muslim life around the world. The Saudis have some tense relations with some fellow Muslim-majority countries, Iran most notable. Has access to Mecca been doled out equally, or have the Saudis favored some countries over others?
Well, Saudi Arabia is a place in which many foreign nationals work for all sorts of reasons. Many of them happen to be Muslim. And they decided to, rather than sort of set up a quota system, from what I understand, they decided to take stock of who within their country might qualify, and then sort of set up a rigorous testing regimen to determine who would be allowed to perform the Hajj. So it wasn't so much as, you know, they're going to exclude Iran, say, this year, Iran being a place with a particularly wide outbreak of COVID-19, but more like, let's just exclude the world, period.
Okay.
Let's exclude the crossing of borders and just deal with it as a local event. And 1,000 being a round number, being a very limited number, and I think also a number in which it's more manageable, and you can make sure these people, to the best of your knowledge, are not carrying the virus. So other than that, Jim, I don't know any other criteria per se that was involved this year.
Have we seen any evidence that countries have been critical of the decisions the Saudis have taken, or is there resignation to the fact that the Saudis are dealing with the same challenges we all are, how to keep people safe given this highly infectious disease?
I think it's more of the latter, Jim. You certainly had, at the beginning of this pandemic, and especially, I would say, around March and April, as countries, majority Muslim and others, were setting strict requirements in place, you had some backlash. In Iran, for example, again, which was an early outbreak country, There were people who stormed mosques who were mad at the decision to end the Friday prayers. And there was some of that expressed elsewhere, but it definitely dissipated as the understanding of this disease became known and the highly infectious nature of it. And again, these are religious services in which people are close together. They're used to being close together. Some societies more than others are all about embracing as well, embracing friends and family, you know, worshiping together. And I think the whole notion here was to try to deter those types of practices. Now, there are lots of large families in the Muslim world, as there are in some other countries, and they will be able to do this amongst themselves, but not in the mass gatherings that you see in a place like the Hajj. It's just, I think it became among the world's, you know, mass events. The Hajj is on that list of some of the biggest mass events that are known, and it quickly became clear it was not going to be possible. And, it, you know, just like events like the Olympics, obviously all sorts of sporting events, all sorts of other sports, cultural entertainment, and so forth. But for religious communities, there is a resignation. There continues to be a pushback that we see in this country, in the U.S. And I think it was in some cases, we've seen that the early reopening of some of the southern states and the Sunbelt states, especially in churches, proved to be areas where there were problems with contagion as well. So it's forcing a reevaluation of the regular weekly or sometimes daily worship that some religions have, Jim.
Yeah, I imagine this is going to be a challenge that Saudi government officials are going to be facing for quite some time, because it's likely to be a while before we get a vaccine. Even if we get a vaccine, it's going to be a long time before that vaccine is widely distributed. So I imagine Saudi Arabia is going to face this question again next year.
Yeah. And again, it's a national question. And certainly the Saudis with an outsized responsibility for harboring the holiest sites in Islam have a huge amount of responsibility. But we're seeing, and we did a feature on our website regarding just the burial practices of various faiths and cultures. And it's involved a reckoning across the board for rituals, really important rituals. You know, you're saying farewell to a loved one. It doesn't get more personal and more profound for many people. And yet it's had to change. And you know, we've seen it in Judaism, in Islam, in Roman Catholicism, last rites being performed, you know, across a technological platform as opposed to in person, for example, Jim. So, and the Saudis, I think, are studying this like anyone else and seeing what areas can there be some sort of substitution done while not being able to obviously replicate the importance of an event like the Hajj. And I think also the Saudis, like other countries, especially countries with some resources, will probably try to see that they can get their hands on any kind of vaccine as soon as possible. Jim, I'm going to stay in the region and move a little bit north to Turkey and talk about the Hagia Sophia. Now, this is a world-famous structure. It was secularized by then-Turkish leader Kemal Atatürk in the early 20th century, and it became a sort of magnificent space to view sort of the overlap of religions. A structure that had been a Christian structure was converted into a Muslim worship space, and now President Erdogan is going to transform the Hagia Sophia back into a mosque. It has aroused a lot of concern, primarily in Christian nations. Vatican, I think, has had some statements about this as well. But Jim, can you tell us a little bit about what's going on here and maybe talk us through a little bit of the history as well?
Certainly, Bob. Well, why don't we begin with the history? The Hagia Sophia, as the Turks call it, was built back in the 6th century by the great Byzantine Emperor Justinian I. It stood as the greatest church in Christendom for more than 900 years. When the Ottomans captured the city in 1453, Ottoman ruler Mehmed the Conqueror immediately converted it into a mosque. It stayed that way until 1934 when, as you pointed out, Kemal Atatürk, Turkey's first president and a man bent on imposing secularism on the new country, ordered it converted into a museum. When that happened, for the first time in centuries, the original Christian mosaics decorating the interior of the Hagia Sophia were uncovered. And as a result, this new museum became a very popular spot for visitors to Istanbul. Again, it's a truly breathtaking structure in a city that has a lot of history and a lot of stunning architecture. Now, of course, as popular as the Hagia Sophia has been for tourists going to Istanbul, many Turks, and not just deeply religious ones, have long wanted to return it to being a mosque, seeing the decision to turn it into a museum as, in essence, a retreat from Turkey's own history in an unnecessary measure to try to reach out to the West. And there has been a Turkish cultural organization that for several years has been pursuing a legal campaign designed to return mosques that have been converted into museums and other secular spaces back to their original purpose. Erdogan has long championed the move to convert the Hagia Sophia back to a mosque. And I suspect that given his disproportionate influence over the Turkish judiciary, that that likely drove the decision. Now, the decision has been very popular in Turkey itself, and that may be one of the reasons why Erdogan pushed it. Obviously, Erdogan is a religious man, heads up a party with deep religious roots, but he's also a politician who's looking for ways to build and sustain his support, given that he's been in power for quite some time, and the Turkish economy is going through some significant economic troubles. I'll note that the decision, I think, was also popular in much of the Muslim world, less so, as you point out, in the West. The Greeks have been particularly vocal about their opposition to the move. Greece, in many ways, sees itself as the protector, the legacy of the Byzantines. And obviously, Greece and Turkey have a very long history of tensions. Now, you've also seen others weigh in on this. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo stated that the United States views a change in the status of the Hagia Sophia as diminishing the legacy of this remarkable building. And the French Foreign Ministry has said that the Hagia Sophia is a symbol of tolerance and diversity, and this is a place that must remain open to all. And I think that takes us really to the big question: what will access to the Hagia Sophia look like in its current incarnation? Now, the Turkish government is very quick to say that it will function much like the way working churches in Europe do that are open to tourists. Think Notre Dame before the fire, Sacré-Cœur in Paris, and other cathedrals across Europe. And the Turks certainly have an incentive to want to maintain access for tourists because tourism is an important industry in Istanbul. I think many people worry that over time that access will become more limited. And here's where you get questions about what responsibility does any individual country have to the rest of the international community in terms of how they maintain and use buildings that are of unique cultural and historical status. So I suspect we will hear more about this in the months and years to come.
You raise a lot of good points there, Jim. I mean, I think back, and you use the term breathtaking, which is exactly right, to describe it. I mean, I was there 25 or so years ago on a snowy day in February, and just, you know, came inside and took my breath away. I had actually just come from visiting another mosque, which is not too far away, a famous mosque in Istanbul called the Blue Mosque. But to be able to walk around, to have the access you have inside Hagia Sophia, you see these massive depictions of various verses of the Quran in Arabic mounted on the walls. But you also see the emergence of these Christian frescoes in certain places in there. And you know it's a holy place, but you don't feel like any other sort of affiliation. It's quite stunning. And it will be very interesting to see if the Turks preserve that as a space for cultural reflection as well as obviously a religious worship. It's hard not to be pessimistic as you see the way Erdogan is, the direction he's taken the country in other ways, but it is quite significant. The other thing I recall from that visit 25 years ago is you still kind of felt the presence of Atatürk in Turkey in those days, even as you were hearing the call to prayer from the various mosques and other things. You still, Atatürk's official presence and imposition of his will, so to speak, was kind of tangible. And it seems like it's Erdogan is nudging him aside ever so more these days.
Oh, very much so. I mean, clearly Erdogan wants to remake Turkey because he opposes the secularism that Atatürk imposed on the country. But I want to go back to this issue of Istanbul, the Hagia Sophia. Again, it, having been there, it is just a remarkable piece of history. I also think Istanbul is a wonderful city. I would encourage anyone thinking of
going there
to go there. It's breathtaking on multiple levels, and you know, being at the confluence of Europe and Asia. And I will note that the Turks have in Istanbul many mosques. You name the Blue Mosque. There's the so-called New Mosque, which is actually, I think, about 450 years old, and a variety of other mosques. And Turks have historically made them open to tourists to go and visit. Obviously, you have to do so respectfully. So I think in that sense, Turkey has a very good tradition of giving access to its mosque. I think the big question that comes with the Hagia Sophia is going to be, will the sort of the Christian heritage of the church, the mosaics, the frescoes, be covered up, not during services for Muslims? I think most would see that as sensible, but would they be permanently covered up? And I think that's some of the fear that's percolating around there. But again, if I can just say about Istanbul, fantastic city, great people, wonderful food, terrific terrain, lots of history, one of my favorites.
Yeah. And there's many other recommendations I can make, but Hagia Sophia is top on the list. And then you go to Topkapi Palace and make sure you go to the bazaars as well. You get the whole
Grand Bazaar. Mazar is out of this world. What a great place. But I think it's time for us to stop acting as spokespeople for the Istanbul Chamber of Commerce and pivot to something happening essentially southwest of Turkey. And I'm talking about the rising tensions between Egypt and Ethiopia and also Sudan over Ethiopia's construction of the so-called Grand Ethiopian Renaissance Dam. Now, this is not a new conflict among these countries. And South Africa's President Cyril Ramaphosa recently convened a meeting of the African Union to discuss the issue and hopefully bring down tensions. Bob, can you fill us in on what's happening in Northeast Africa?
Absolutely. As we continue our great survey of the ancient world in modern day history, Jim. So you were talking about a project that is about 10 years or so in the making. What's making it more newsy at the moment is that it's very close to completion. There is a massive reservoir behind the dam that is filling up and has been filling up more quickly than normal because it's the heavy rain season in the part of Ethiopia that feeds the Blue Nile. And so that aroused a great deal of concern by the major downriver countries, Sudan, through which it flows and on its way into Egypt and Egypt. There has been a flurry of diplomacy going on. You mentioned Cyril Ramaphosa. The U.S. has actually been involved in trying to broker agreement as well. You've had not only the State Department, but you've had the Treasury involved. And there has been some talk of the U.S. trying to leverage aid to Ethiopia to get it to be accommodating towards the concerns of Egypt, especially, which is a U.S. ally. And what's happening is a discussion about, according to the latest round of discussions, is trying to create a shared understanding and agreement about the way in which water will be parceled out, especially during periods when there isn't so much water, when there's a drought. And you're talking about a desert region in particular, very dry regions in both Sudan and Egypt that rely heavily on the Nile. I think something like 90% of Egypt's population is along the Nile. It's a very important lifeline in so many ways. And I think there needs to be some sort of formal understanding with confidence that these countries will have access to the water the Nile provides. And Ethiopia, for its part, some sense of its own ownership of what the dam is bringing it, which is a great deal of energy. It's going to bring online a large number of people who haven't been able to be attached to a consistent, reliable energy grid. And it's also, it should be noted, something, a project of immense national pride. I mean, it was started under an authoritarian leader. The current president, Abiy Ahmed, has been supportive of it, although it seemed at times a little bit ambivalent about it. But this is something in which Ethiopians have been for years sending in small, medium, large checks to help support the project of this dam, which has cost something along the lines of $4.5 to $5 billion in a country that of not great means. And so there's a sort of a vested nature in terms of what it means for Ethiopians, for average Ethiopians. And so it's coming at a crucial moment for them nationally. It's coming at a time whenever water enters the picture, especially in this part of the world, you're going to arouse a lot of passions. So it is incredibly important that they reach some sort of understanding and not resort to any sort of conflict in a region that has its share of conflicts. Egypt itself is newly involved in a conflict on its border in Libya. And so I think there's a great deal of concern that diplomacy prevail, but the seasonal rains have sort of hastened the discussion. And July is sort of seen as this crucial month for them to come to some sort of formal agreement, because this appears to be the time or the near future when this dam could come online.
Oh, Bob, I will note that control over water resources is a big issue in a lot of countries' relations. You can think, for example, of rivers that drain from China into the Mekong. You can think of the laws and treaties that govern water originating in the United States coming down in the Rio Grande, what Mexico can take and what the United States can take. So this is an issue we see around the world. But in this particular case involving the Egyptians and the Ethiopians, the phrase I used was increasing tensions. Can you maybe put that in a little bit of context for us? Are we really near the potential war between the two countries? And if we did have conflict, what do we think it would look like?
Well, it might be overstating it to say they're near conflict, but tensions and sort of hard feelings seem to be closer to the surface now than they have been at any time in this project. Again, it's the nature of where these countries find themselves at. Egypt, it's now been led by Mr. Al-Sisi for close to 6 years. He is used to sort of wielding a tough stick domestically, and as I said, has newly gotten involved and is starting to get involved, it seems like, in Libya's expanding civil war. war and would be expected to stick up for Egyptians' rights and to its own water, its own patrimony in some ways, access to the Blue Nile and not making sure it can't get cut off by this country to the south. However, as I said, Ethiopia sees this project as a huge part of its emergence as a nation. This is a country that is moving painstakingly towards potential democratic growth. As I said, Mr. Ahmed has now been in power, I believe, almost 2 years, has seen as somebody who's trying to reform the country, although they still have a great deal of problems involving ethnic divisions, to say the least. Sudan, also in the path of the Blue Nile, is a country that could be also on the cusp of transitioning to a democratic reformist, say, government, with a great deal at stake there as well. So these are countries in which there are things happening at the leadership level of great importance. And a huge aspect of sort of nationhood sovereignty and prestige is control over a resource like water, Jim. So I think, again, there were images that were broadcast showing this filling up of the dam in recent weeks, which just set off alarm bells. I think you can't rule out that it could lead to some sort of skirmishing, at least initially, in terms of a full-fledged conflict. That still seems to be a bit off. You have the African Union involved. You have the U.S. seemingly willing to expend some capital, both political as well as real money, in terms of various financing arms the U.S. uses. But in the U.S. case, it seems to be, according to the reporting I've seen, directed more at Ethiopia and using it as leverage to Ethiopia, as opposed to the other countries involved, who see themselves as being cut off from a vital resource. So will cooler heads prevail? We'll have to see. There's certainly a possibility. It could be. It's just, again, the scale of this project, the importance of the Nile, the sort of transitional nature of the leadership in these countries make it a bit of a tricky period right now.
I'll just note as a matter of geography that Ethiopia and Egypt do not share a land border. Indeed, Ethiopia is several hundred miles away from Egypt at its closest point. So any tensions you see that erupt into warfare are not going to be your typical idea you might have of one country crossing the border invading another.
That is a good point. I mean, I'm not sure what conflict looks like between those two countries, frankly. And again, Sudan is the country in between them, and Sudan going through its own transition at the moment. And it's not clear, as they deal with trying to usher out an authoritarian regime, whether or not there are authoritarian impulses that could come sweep back into power there, you know, over an issue like the dam. It's not clear at all. So again, we'll see if the African Union is able to play a meaningful role here. We'll see how much the U.S. invests in this as well. And given everything else going on in the region, not to mention some of the climate change influenced developments, and let's not forget the locusts that are still afflicting the Horn of Africa. You know, the last thing they need is a actual land or air battle involving a Grand Dam project. Jim, we've talked our way into the figure of the week portion of the podcast. So please, who or what is your figure of the week?
Bob, my figure of the week is a number. It's the number 100. No, I'm not thinking of the question on the Montreal Cognitive Assessment Test that has gotten a lot of play this week, in which asks you to count back from 100 by 7. I'll do it: 93, 86, 79, 72, 65, and so forth. Rather, I'm thinking of the number 100 as in the fact that as of this Sunday, the United States will be 100 days out from Election Day. So we are about to go full swing into the election campaign. I'll note that polls show that former Vice President Joe Biden has a significant lead. Odds are good that that gap will shrink. We've seen that happen in previous presidential elections. Here's where I'll do our quadrennial public service announcement. People should take care in reading polls. Always look at poll averages, not at a single poll. When you look at polls, pay attention to whether they're polls of all voters or of likely voters. And always remember that when you're talking about national opinion polls in the United States, that the U.S. presidential election is really 50 state in one federal district election. So national polls can tell you how the popular vote will shake out, but not necessarily how the electoral college vote will shake out, as we saw in 2016, where public opinion polls, at least nationally, were pretty much spot on, but the winner of the popular vote was not the winner of the electoral college. And I think as we go toward Election Day, one of the big questions is going to be who, in fact, is going to turn out. Now, that's a tough thing to do in a normal election year, and 2020 is anything but a normal year. And there's reason to believe that the pandemic may suppress turnout, either because voters decide it's too risky to go to the polls, or they get to the polls only to find out that they face interminably long lines. I don't think anybody knows how that might break on partisan terms, whether it benefits Democrats or benefits Republicans, but it is something that we face. Likewise, we're likely to see a rise in mail-in voting and absentee voting. Here, the rules vary state by state. I don't get the sense that there's been a broad movement to try to upgrade our election rules in most states to face the very real challenges that we know we're going to face on election day. And as you look at a lot of the mail-in balloting or absentee balloting conducted by states in recent weeks and months, a fair number of those ballots have been tossed out for not being completed properly. I note that California tossed out about 100,000 mail-in ballots during its recent presidential primary. That was about 1.5% of all the ballots cast. New Jersey apparently tossed out something like 10% of the mail-in ballots for its primary. And again, this is because people don't fill it out completely, fail to sign it, or the signature doesn't clearly match what's on the records. Now, none of this is going to matter if either Joe Biden or Donald Trump wins in a landslide. But if we have a close election, we could end up in a legal morass that will make us look back fondly on Gore v. Bush back in 2000.
Yeah, Jim, you touch on something that's becoming more and more talked about. There's a cover story rather ominous in today's Washington Post about the very real prospect of a challenged result, and especially if President Trump, who's been talking about his distrust of mail-in ballots, raising that as an issue that, you know, he will not accept the results in the event of his loss, and what that all means, and you know, what are the systems that are supposed to kick into place to deal with this? I mean, I still vividly remember Gore versus Bush, actually, in the so-called Hanging Chad.
Hanging Chads.
Yeah, Hanging Chads in the state of Florida, where they were doing a massive recount, and these Chads that had to be pushed through all the way, or the votes were not counted. And that still ended up in the Supreme Court with a decision that some people, a number of people did not agree with, but which Vice President Gore agreed to abide by. And that ended it. But that was a long period of uncertainty in that era. You know, now in the midst of a pandemic, you have a situation with strife in some major U.S. cities, and the federal forces being called in by the president, what some people say is a culture war being mounted on top of everything else. It's just the stakes seem to be higher and higher all the time, Jim. So we have yet another disconcerting figure to consider this week.
They are very much higher, Bob, this time around. But I will note, when we look at Election Day, one other possibility is that the day after Election Day, November 4th, we may not know who won. Again, if votes are sufficiently close in one or more states, you will then have to turn to counting all of these absentee ballots. In some states, that could take quite a long time. And as you note, you have the potential for all kind of litigation. I could imagine having challenges about whether mail-in votes have been through a proper chain of custody. We've seen in the past where in some state elections, votes have been tossed out because nobody could account for where they were for certain periods of time. So it'd be very interesting to see how this goes. This could be a historic U.S. election in more than one way. But Bob, let's find out what is your figure of the week?
Jim, my figure as a person is 44-year-old Maxim Krivosh of Ukraine. And in a week in which Europe was mostly preoccupied with a historic summit involving its recovery fund in response to the pandemic, Mr. Krivosh's story stole the headlines for a little while. And that is because he seized a number of hostages and was in a standoff with security forces in a city in western Ukraine for a while before securing the intervention of President Zelensky, something that seemed like a chapter out of the Black Mirror TV series. One of his demands was that the president support a video that stood for animal rights, a 2005 video narrated by Joaquin Phoenix, the American actor, that was about animal rights, which is one of the causes that Mr. Krivosh feels strongly about. President Zelensky did. He posted the short video on his Facebook page with the words, "Everyone should watch the 2005 film Earthlings." That was enough for Mr. Krivosh to end his standoff. The hostages were released. He was taken into custody. The post was later taken down by Mr. Zelensky's team. And so ended a bizarre episode that showed potential impact, let's say, of social media in daily affairs in some countries.
Bizarre certainly is the right word for it, Bob.
Yeah. Again, check out the first season of Black Mirror and see if you don't see some parallels in a few places. That's all I'll say about that.
Fair point.
And that's our look at the turbulent world next week. Here's some other stories to keep an eye on. President of the Philippines, Rodrigo Duterte, delivers his State of the Nation address virtually. NASA plans to launch its Mars 2020 mission. And North and South Korea mark the anniversary of the Korean War armistice.
Please subscribe to The World Next Week on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And leave us a review while you're at it. They help us get noticed and improve the show. Please note that opinions expressed in The World Next Week are solely those of the hosts or our guests, not of CFR, which takes no institutional positions on matters of policy. Today's program was produced by Zoe Collins with senior producer Jeremy Sherlock. Zoe also doubled as our recording engineer. Special thanks to Anna Grazer, Noah Mulligan, and Anna Shortridge for their assistance. Our theme music is provided by Miguel Herrero and licensed under Creative Commons. This is Jim Lindsay saying goodbye.
And this is Bob McMahon saying so long and stay safe.